when I was in college, like 15 years ago or so. At some point in the middle of the fall, there would be a beautiful day. It would be sunny. The leaves would have started to turn cold, crisp, but not too cold. Definitely not rainy at all. Maybe a little bit of clouds in the sky. And that was the weather forecast for the day. And the campus bells would ring, and it would announce that the day was Mountain Day. And Mountain Day was this glorious day when all classes and activities were canceled, and all of the college vans and club rent-a-cars and things like that were available to sign out. And the idea was that you took advantage of the beautiful fall weather, and you went hiking or went outdoors or went along the bike trails and climbed a mountain. And I feel like today in Tacoma is Mountain Day. Maybe just because I came back from around Mount Rainier and everything, but it is a beautiful, gorgeous autumn day.
It is. I'm rather fond of this kind of weather where I still have to put on a heavy jacket and a scarf to go outside, but it looks really nice.
Yeah, you're not going to get dumped on.
You are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is, well, at the mountain. And so you got me, Becky Friedman, as your host today. And with me in the studio are Josh and Nick. How are you, Josh?
Doing good.
And Nick, welcome back from last week.
It's good to be back.
It definitely feels good today to be in the studio, knowing that it is beautiful outside, knowing that the Mount Rainier has been blanketed with snow more recently. We're hoping that our snowpack really is able to build up this winter and things like that. And because we love our Earth and we love our planet, you know, we as atheists aren't all nihilists, right?
I know that I'm not.
I don't even know if I know any nihilists.
Nihilist atheists? No?
Period. I mean,
it's such a common thing where you say, oh, you're an atheist. You must not believe in anything. You must hate the world. You must be looking forward to meeting the devil. To which that last one's always a funny one because it's like, you know, you forgot who's the one that believes in devils and demons and things like that. Yeah, the folks that also believe in the rest of the theology, like, oh, I don't know, Christians. So as an atheist, if you don't believe in God, you're not going to believe in the devil either.
Well, or just in a related sense, Josh, you like metal, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Does that make you a really, really angry, vicious person?
Actually, I find it calming.
Checkmate.
You heard it here at Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I want to share some really good news that is not the good news that other people seem to talk about when they find out that you're an atheist. But this is legitimate news of things happening in the world that we've been kind of sitting on, I think, since August, since this first came up on our radar. But it's October, so I finally want to share it. And that is that women in Bangladesh will no longer be compelled to testify to virgin status on their marriage certificates. The country's high court ruled that the term Kumari, which can mean young woman or virgin, be replaced with the marriage, be replaced on the marriage form with Obibahita, which simply and unambiguously signifies an unmarried woman. Applicants still have two other options, widowed or divorced. Additionally, men must now also provide their status on marriage application forms.
That's a small step. I think it's a very good step.
It's kind of weird that like they had to actually say that they're a virgin, or I mean, it was ambiguous about it whether they're a young woman or a virgin. But
and now, you know, Josh, you and I both have had experiences filling out marriage certificates, right? And or marriage application licenses, right?
Right.
So in the U.S., you are at this point only permitted to marry one person. And you have to testify to the fact that you are not married to any other person at that time and things like that. And as far as I remember, that's the only thing you got to do. You just be like, are you married? Nope. And in Bangladesh, I'm going to say, Josh, was that your experience also? You had to say something like you weren't currently married to someone else, right?
Yeah, right.
And I mean, imagine, though, being tasked with saying, now, what exactly is the nature of your not being married to anyone currently? Is it because you're divorced? Is it because you're widowed or a widower? Or is it because you are currently someone who has never experienced carnal knowledge of another person? Like, that's a fairly intimate question to be asked about, far as I'm thinking.
Especially since it's like a legal form. So you declare that you're a virgin on a legal form and you're not a There's no actual law for it, but I mean, in the Bible, and Bangladeshi is Christian, or
no? Bangladesh is a majority Muslim country.
Muslim, okay, but yeah, so still read a lot of Old Testament in there. So I mean, to not be a virgin is a stoning offense.
Well, and to say that this is something that only applies to women, one, gets under my skin because it's looking at something that is definitely not egalitarian in treating men and women differently in this respect, because men didn't have to say, you know, that when they're first getting married, you know, declare their previous status of intimate contact with anyone. You know, I think that one of the things this speaks to is that in our language for so long, words like maiden, for instance, in English, often had a connotation of someone who was a virgin. And to say that something is, you know, someone is a young woman is ambiguous when you use the term maiden. It's some of the things that lead Christians to say that, oh, well, Jesus's, you know, divine birth with Mary's immaculate conception was foretold, because at some point in the Hebrew scriptures, it says a virgin will bear a child. And it's like, actually, that word can kind of just mean a young lady. I mean, a 16-year-old, right? But in language, so many of our terms for young women have been colored and characterized by these religious and patriarchal ideas that says that, well, the only way to be a young woman is to be someone who is untouched by man, right?
Well, it's like the difference between Mrs. and Miss, I guess, if you go back, you know, a couple hundred years.
There's like another one.
The origins.
And saying, you know, you have to declare whether you are owned by someone else or belonging to someone else. You have to have your method of address be determined by your marital status rather than having an honorific that stands on its own. I mean, it wasn't too far away. It was far closer than 100 years ago when the honorific MS, Ms., was revolutionized. I mean, and started being adopted in the middle of the 20th century. So I think that this is a really, it looks like a small thing. It's changing one word on a form. But if you are a young woman, or a woman in her 20s or a woman in her 30s who has never been married before in Bangladesh, previously you had to say either I am someone who has been married and I'm divorced, or I'm someone who has been married and my former husband died, or you could be someone that's never married, 30 years old, and theoretically be forced to lie on government forms about your sexual history.
Well, also another thing, I mean, it says men must now also provide their status on marriage application forms. They didn't have to provide their status before?
No, not in this case. So this is something that is leading Bangladesh to be more egalitarian in the institution of marriage.
And I think probably more, this, like I said earlier, this is a good first step. What I would like to see, what I would like to see more of, is societal acceptance of more egalitarian.
People should be able to define their own relationships.
Yeah, it's not the it's not some bureaucrat's business. You know what you do with, you know, in the privacy of your own home.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be poly, you should have that, absolutely have that freedom. I mean, the government should have no stake in defining what your relationships that you prefer are, because that's what it is. It's you prefer to be in this stasis. It's your choice. I mean, to me, that's the ultimate freedom.
If it makes you happy and doesn't hurt anyone.
And
consenting adults.
Yeah, all of those things precisely, that we as folks that are not beholden to religious dictates can say, no, this is the way that we want to live our lives. The fact, though, is that even in countries that are not governed by religious laws, even in the United States, which is ostensibly a pluralistic society, we still have these ideas about the structures of relationships and how you should conduct yourself before marriage and things like that, that are still holdovers from these religious ideas. The fact that there is any concept or obsession with a woman's sexual history status that can be deemed or determined to be called virginity or not is something that medically has no bearing on anything, and socially, if people would be more accepting, wouldn't have any bearing either.
And it also forces people to go through the devil's loophole.
Oh, would you like to say more about that one, Josh, or will you leave that there?
Well, it's oats.
I was thinking that you were probably talking about Brett Kavanaugh, but I guess you're not.
The Devil's Triangle? No, no. I'm thinking of, I'm trying to think of the comedic duo that has that song, that is the loophole, the Christian loophole song. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Is it Garfunkel and Oates?
Garfunkel and Oates. They have the alternative methods to keep their virginity. And that's actually very common.
Well, and these are things that, you know, without getting to be too detailed in the knowledge and explication of intimate acts, you know, these are things that that sometimes people would feel pressured to do because of whatever their religious upbringing say are valid or invalid ways of being and experiencing your own sexuality and humanity. And when you have young people that are coerced into doing certain intimate acts to avoid other intimate acts, I don't feel like that is a true way of bringing someone into their being, whether you're religious or not. And I would like to see all of those things kind of go. You guys want to hear some neat, awesome news that is more about the inclusion of all people, regardless of gender, regardless of sexual orientation, things like that?
Good news is very welcomed right now. We need it.
Very much so.
So a city in Iowa is actually ignoring a federal demand that officials revert the LGBTQ inclusive crosswalk art to white stripes. Not the band White Stripes, but, you know, just the zebra crossings, right? The zebra crosswalks. The Ames City Council and the Iowa State University's Office of Diversity and Inclusion had collaborated to paint custom crosswalks at the intersection of two major city streets as part of an inclusive outreach effort. Two crosswalks feature a pride rainbow with black and brown stripes. One crossing features non-binary pride colors of black, purple, yellow, and white. And a fourth crossing features light pink, sky blue, and white to honor transgender individuals. 2 days after the crosswalk's September 3rd unveiling, the Federal Highway Administration sent a letter directing the city to, quote, take necessary steps to remove the non-compliant crosswalk art as soon as it is feasible, claiming that the art posed a danger to pedestrians. None of the city streets involved is a federal road, a U.S. highway, or an interstate freeway.
Because, you know, state rights.
It is strange that the party that is most often known for promoting states' rights, you know, those would be the Republican Party, which is now in the highest reaches of office, is now responsible for saying, hey, state, city, small municipality that has done this particular thing, everything must conform to the federal standards of crosswalks.
I don't even know what the federal standards for crosswalks are, because even if you go between different cities in the same state or even in the same county, sometimes they look very different.
Yeah, you've seen ones that are green in the middle. You've seen ones that are lines that are white and paved, white and black lines, right?
Yeah, you have those super confusing diagonal ones.
Ooh, those are fun ones, too.
Those drive me nuts.
Or if you go to the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle, you will see rainbow painted crosswalks that the federal government has said absolutely nothing about, as far as I know.
Shh, don't give them any ideas, Nick.
No, but I want the fight to come this way.
You bring up a good point that a lot of neighborhoods that have been known as hubs for LGBT community groups and things like that will often throughout June and July, Pride Month, Coming Out Week and Coming Out Day and things like that, will decorate their intersection crossings in ways that are celebratory and inclusive. Capitol Hill was one that I saw here. In San Francisco, in the Mission District, and in different areas, you'll see ones that have flags, and you'll see ones that have national flags and ethnic flags. You'll see ones that have LGBT flags. Right here in Tacoma, during our daffodil festivals throughout April, which is throughout all of Pierce County, you'll see the crosswalks and intersections that have daffodils painted in the middle of them. Have we ever gotten slaps on the wrists notices saying that a flower painted in the middle of your intersection is a traffic hazard?
I think possibly because they know that they're going to get a lot of backlash if they do that in Western Washington. probably not, or they were thinking probably not so much in Ames, Iowa. However, Ames is not exactly a deep red city.
Well, when you look at Iowa, it's one of the things that, one of the really interesting kind of places in our nation that blends together to make that purple color on the maps, right? On those electoral maps.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we got to deal with Klobuchar right now.
Oh, okay. All right. I sense that you have feelings about that, Josh. But it is very strange to hear and see the involvement of the federal government. Now, in terms of what are those highway standards, yeah, there are ways to test to see which ones, which kind of markings are most visible. That's why we have some kind of standardization of what kind of street signage are adopted. But, you know, you'll have different ways of stating things from state to state, even on actual federally funded states. I mean, my favorite thing in New Mexico when I lived there was the very funny warning message that said, caution. Dust storms may exist.
Haboobs.
But will they exist here and now, or will they exist halfway across the world?
It's like a wonderful philosophical question as you're driving through flat stretches of nothingness, right? Yeah. Dust storms may exist, they may not. Will we ever know? Whereas in other places that the haboob or the dust storm is something that's common, it'll say, caution, watch for dust storms, right? Or dust storms possible. But caution, dust storms may exist is just this deliciously phrased, you know, existential question that leaves us all wondering. And you might say, like, maybe the federal government might use their powers a little bit more to actually study whether those are most effective and what kind of messages are most clear to people. There have been lots of studies and investment into what green road signs should say, the brown ones that are for your rest stops or your points of interest, the blue ones that are the amenities, the gas stations and the fast food joints, the colors of different kind of warning signs and how they can be most universally recognized. But you're right, Nick, with crosswalks, there are so many different kinds of ways to do crosswalks. And I think that the only standard and the one that Ames, Iowa came up with was, well, there's two big white lines that stretch all the way across the intersection in question, and whatever fills in the middle isn't really specified. So I think we're in the clear here.
And if they really did care about pedestrian safety, they might offer some federal dollars up to some poorer communities that, well, used to have painted crosswalks, but now don't because of many, many years of lack of maintenance.
What the thing that, you know, how this intersects with Ask an Atheist is it sends my little alarm bells and my skeptic bells ringing, because I'm saying, what business does the federal government have saying these particular painted crosswalks? Well, these are crosswalks that are celebrating the inclusion of the full spectrum of humanity within a particular community and society. And we know that with folks in power who are stridently evangelical, Republican, nationalists, and use their Christian identities to then say, this is how we should enact government. This is someone that is getting in on looking at what a municipality is doing and saying, we don't want anything that looks like any kind of government being inclusive towards gay people. We don't want the rainbow, right? The rainbow should be reserved just for, I don't know, stories of Noah, right?
Well, how about this? They can just change, the city of Ames, Iowa could skirt around this just by saying, you know what? We think it looks nice. We don't think it means anything. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I'm really hoping that no one would do that. I'm proud of Ames, Iowa for saying, no, this isn't just about putting a rainbow in the middle. We're doing an updated inclusive rainbow that includes our black and brown stripes to include the struggles and recognize the struggles of non-white LGBT individuals. We're putting something. I didn't even know until this story that there was a flag that was designed to embrace and identify non-binary individuals. That's something that's bringing awareness to me, and I don't even live in Ames, Iowa.
I was the same way, and I'm also on your side. When I am glad that Ames is sticking up for this. I think we're all in agreement, though, that the Federal Highway Administration doesn't really have any reason to regulate this.
Well, they have lots of reasons. They just don't have any authority to do so.
But yeah, why do they? Why do they need to comment?
I don't like their reasons. Hey, federal government, stay out of people's marriages, stay out of people's bedrooms, stay out of people's gender expressions, stay out of dictating people's ways of loving each other. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, and we'll be back after the break. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, where you're listening to Becky and Josh and Nick. You know, guys, there were two stories this week that caught my attention, and both of them had to do with cops. And, well, the first one is in one of my former adopted hometowns of Phoenix, where the Phoenix Police Department has indefinitely postponed a prayer vigil titled United in Christ, A Call to Prayer. A flyer advertising the event featured Police Chief Jerry Williams alongside officers with their heads bowed. Arizona's ACLU chapter, along with concerned citizens, filed letters of complaint that advised that such events violate the Constitution by blurring the line of separation between church and state. The police vigil, co-sponsored by the Arizona-based missionary organization Bridge Builders, would have been the sixth time that the department would have hosted the Phoenix PD Prayer Watch, which Bridge Builders advertised as a call for God to cover and protect law enforcement personnel across Arizona who sacrifice so much to keep us safe on the streets and in our homes. Guys, what do you make of this? This is not the first time it would have happened. This would have been the sixth.
I just don't understand the fact that they don't understand how this is not unifying for their community. If they're trying to do a unifying thing for their community, dividing lines across by religion is not the way to do it.
There are many ways to have rallies in support of, like, we hope you are safe. We hope you do good. We hope you are well taken care of, without bringing religion into it,
without casting magic spells.
Now, do you think that in any circumstance it would be appropriate for, I don't know, maybe there's congregants that go to their Sunday church service, and they said, and now this part in our service, we're going to have all first responders stand and we'll offer a blessing for first responders to protect them and keep them safe.
There's a difference between a church doing that on their own time and having someone in their official capacity as a government employee or a government leader facilitating it on government time.
Yeah, I'm sure they were getting paid for this too. Like, the cops are probably still getting paid to show up to these events.
Well, the other interesting thing about this is that the rally was going to be right outside city council. So this is something that's very highly visible. It has the auspices of something. It looks like it's something that's either city sponsored or police department sponsored. All of those things kind of blur the line. It's not super uncommon to have individual congregations saying we're going to offer a prayer for the president. I grew up in a Jewish environment, and in a lot of our standard prayer books, there will be, and here's where you say the prayer for the state of Israel, and here's where you say the prayer for your own personal government leaders, and here's where you say, because, you know, can God guide you and make you have good moral decisions and things like that. Those are things that don't surprise me and are super common. But the gall of saying, here's a poster, here's a flyer, and we're working together with this evangelical missionary organization. And the fact that this is the sixth time that this would have happened, where were we the other 5 years? What were we doing? It kind of brings to mind that we need to bring this to the fore. We should follow these kinds of organizations on social media. We should keep account of what police departments and municipalities and cities and towns are doing. We should be following these folks and how they're using their government positions to, well, in this case, promote religion. Pretty clear cut to me. Do you guys think that there's anything, not clear cut about this?
I think you summed it up very well.
Yeah, this is all about Christians trying to assert control and authority. They're trying to say that they are the authority.
But what about the potential backlash for police officers who overtly wish to not attend this rally?
Ooh, that's a good point.
Yeah, right, because there's that Sikh officer that was killed in, I know it was New York, but not all officers are Christian, and there is no reason for them to be.
What would be the feeling of if any of us were, for instance, in a place of government authority and our employers said, come show up at this event and get a blessing from someone. I think that would make me ultra uncomfortable. And it would be difficult to then speak out against that because your job's at stake.
Yeah. And then, I mean, you're basically saying everybody else that's not that religion is going to, it doesn't deserve a blessing of any sort. And you're basically saying like they don't matter.
Do you think there's a way that people who are not Christian can get across the very nature of how divisive these kinds of events are? Because, you know, we as atheists have gone to different rallies and gone to different things. Growing up myself as someone who's non-Christian but was part of a minority religion, it was always very hard to say, like, hey, remember, not everyone is this big chunk of humanity. Like, there's other folks here. And a lot of times, you know, in my personal childhood experience and then as my adult atheist experience, you get written off as, well, we love you too, and it's all the same God, and, well, there's many paths to divinity. What problem do you have with this? Why is it divisive? And I've run into that so many times that I'm thinking maybe we're not so effective in conveying to individuals that this is not uniting. This is alienating for individuals. What do you guys think?
I think they just want it to be that way. I think it's not the problem with our message. It's the problem that they don't want to listen to the message. They want to be correct.
Even with an organization called Bridge Builders, you'd think that they, you know, we could capitalize on that, building bridges and connections between people.
That's just Jesus, because he's the bridge to God.
Oh, that's the bridge they're talking about.
That's the bridge they're talking about.
Nick, what about you? Have you ever experienced that kind of backlash where people just kind of seem to be aghast that you would feel alienated by something like this?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to explain to people who have not experienced it themselves. But it is like, oh, well, we all believe in the same God. It's like, no. It's kind of like saying to someone who is lactose intolerant or someone who just doesn't like dairy, like, oh, well, we all like this. We all like different types of cheese, or we all like different types of yogurt.
And there's some of us that don't like it at all and can't eat it.
And those are, and I know I hate to analogize something that has brought me a lot of anxiety over the years to something as simple as cheese, but it's hard to analogize to people who haven't experienced it. It's easier for me to talk about this stuff with people who are of minority religions, people who are Muslims or Hindu or Jewish. They tend to understand it a lot more than the Christians that I've talked to about this.
Yeah, that's often because they're not coming from a point of authority either.
It's a very interesting kind of camaraderie that an atheist can find with someone of a non-dominant religion as well. And I think that's in some cases, could be a missed opportunity. And I would love to hear from listeners what kind of things you think are maybe missed opportunities for an atheist to collaborate with individuals of minority faiths and minority cultures in the face of what has come to be a Christian and American nationalistic linked identity and the assumption that it must be good for everyone and it must be harmless for anyone. And if you say anything to counter that, you say, oh, Christians are being so attacked. And it's I would love to hear from listeners. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio. What kind of thoughts folks have on that? You know, we've got another story that's really been vexing a lot of individuals and been touching the hearts of individuals around the country, and that has to do with the murder trial of Amber Geiger, who was convicted of murdering Botham Jean. And it's been gripping the nation in so many ways, because you have a woman who had the semblance of power through being a cop. You have the dynamic and the disproportionate, you know, power of race involved, since Geiger was a white woman and her victim was a black man, and truly a victim, having done nothing other than sitting in his own home and suffered murder at the hands of essentially a home invader. When Geiger thought that she was walking into her own apartment. But there's something that, Josh, has been really getting under your skin about the conclusion to this case. Am I right?
Yeah, so basically, she got convicted, which is kind of unusual because that doesn't happen. So, and she's sentenced to 10 years, which seems lenient. But also on top of that, she got a hug from the judge.
And also the victim's brother hugged her.
Which is fine. Honestly, I don't have a problem with that so much, but the judge hugging this convicted criminal and then giving this convicted criminal a book of a certain type and then telling them a verse that they need to study.
So a group dedicated to the separation of church and state has filed a complaint with the Texas State Commission on Judicial Conduct against the judge who presided over the murder trial of former cop Amber Geiger. Judge Tammy Kemp gifted Geiger a Bible, instructed her on specific passages to read, stated that God has a purpose for Geiger, and told the woman that she could be forgiven. Freedom from Religion Foundation contends that Kemp's actions as a sitting judge were inappropriate and unconstitutional. You seem to be in agreement with this.
Yeah, that's massively inappropriate. I mean, the judge's actions are not justified by any stretch.
Do you think that there was any aspect to the judge's actions that could have been attributed to a cultural pressure to performatively forgive this woman? The judge herself happened to be a black woman. The victim of Amber Geiger was a black man. And do you think that this judge who... If you're a black person in a position of authority, you have experienced discrimination. You have experienced people's conscious and unconscious bias. I am certain that a black woman judge in Texas has experienced overt racism against her. Do you think that her actions could be attributed to any kind of pressure to rise above it and be the bigger person to counter what, you know, people's ideas of this judge as a qualified person, you know, might be?
I don't know if that's the case, but that still doesn't justify actually what the judge's actions were after that.
Okay.
It's still not justified for the judge to give the convicted criminal a hug. Somebody that murdered somebody. It was a flat out murder, and it should not have gone down this way. This showed favoritism for a crime that should not deserve it.
Nick, what are your thoughts on this?
What really troubles me is, and I would feel the same way if any other public official, even someone who is an educator, uses in the course of doing their job religion as like, you need to do this, you need to do it this way, this is the way that you can become a better person. That's... You can do that on your own time, away from your professional post. But when you are sitting at the bench in your robes with a gavel in your hand, I better not see any John 3:16 or handing Bibles out to convicted felons.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, the counter argument to that is, well, they swear on the Bible.
You don't have to swear on the Bible.
You don't have to, but they do.
I've appeared as a juror in two different trials, and I was thankfully in Washington State only asked to raise my arm and swear or affirm that I would fulfill my duties. And it's amazing that, you know, that's the default in Washington. I was very pleased to see and hear that. In other places, I imagine in Texas, one can swear on the Bible and are able to say, I just raise my hand and swear or affirm. Because there are people whose religious backgrounds and sincerely held beliefs prevent them from taking oaths to anyone other than God. And so you just say, yeah, I'll do that. I affirm that.
I remember when I was on jury duty a few years ago, the judge, when she was swearing people in to testify, she said something along the lines of, do you swear under threat of perjury that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
There was no under threat of perjury, not under threat of cosmic retribution from any deity.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. There was nothing so help you God, which you'll see in all the TVs and movies.
I don't understand. Like, we revere the Constitution, supposedly. So why isn't the Constitution the basis of swearing in? Like, I mean, that should answer the question, period. I mean, it's a legal thing. It's a legal thing. So it needs to have a legal backing all the way through it, not any kind of supernatural stuff attached to it?
Well, because there is a significant portion of the country who believes that there is something that was definitely above the Constitution in their eyes.
Every single one of them will lie if it benefits them. Every single one of them, and I'm including myself in that, I'm sure.
It's a bold contention that Josh is making here. One of the things that I think that we're not focusing on here is that this woman has just been convicted. Yes, she is about to serve her sentence. Yes, she flat out murdered someone, but she still has the rights not to be proselytized to. She still has, we've seen in lots of court cases about the rights of incarcerated individuals, that they don't have to be coerced. They have the right to not be coerced into anything religious. And this woman, essentially, Amber Geiger, at that moment, was a captive audience. She was captive. She didn't have the right to say, I'm going to plug my ears, la, 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 not listen to the judge proselytize and witness to me. Now, do I want to favor Amber Geiger in any particular things? No, I think that her sentence was incredibly lenient. You know, it skirted the general minimum for murder charges in the state of Texas. I don't want to justify any of those kinds of things. I just don't want this to be a precedent that judges can have their captive, defendants be there having to listen to judges witnessing.
And not only are they a captive audience, but when you are literally in the process of being convicted of a crime, you are in a very emotionally vulnerable state.
Ooh, good call.
And this judge, I believe, and like you said, I have no sympathy towards Amber Geiger, but I believe that the judge was taking advantage of someone who was just convicted while they were likely in a very emotionally vulnerable state.
So rather than saying we want to protect Amber Geiger's rights, we say, hey, judge, be held to the standard of being a judge and doing your duty and not victimizing any other individuals. Because if she's likely to do this to Amber Geiger in such a high-profile case, what's to say that, you know, let's look into the judge's background and see how many other times she's told or advised or instructed an individual that she deems to have been lost and unforgiven to say, no, you can be forgiven. Start here. Who knows whether this is part of her regular standard practice or not? I want to take us now to Kentucky, where we're looking also at someone who is using their position of authority to proselytize, to witness, to, we're no stranger here to Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin, right? We've talked about him before. But he took to Facebook recently and to traditional media to promote the Bring Your Bible to School Day, an event started by the radical right-wing evangelical Christian group Focus on the Family. Bevin enjoined students to bring their Bibles to school on October 3rd, a right already constitutionally guaranteed to public school youth. Bevin further pushed students to share biblical readings with peers and to bring extras for classmates, ending his post with the hashtag WeRKY, Kentucky. So we are Kentucky. He also asserted that one needn't be a person of faith to recognize that the most well-read, most published book in the history of the world is the Bible for a reason. Hey, guys, we're not people of faith. Do you recognize that the Bible is the most well-published and well-read book for a reason?
You know what? Nickelback is a very popular band. It doesn't make them good.
Or God. I mean, what is the reason behind the Bible being the most published and most read book in the world?
Basically, because people keep on pushing it as authority.
So,
nobody
coercion.
Nobody reads it. Well, nobody truly reads it. They just pick through it and then proclaim it as such.
Well, and over the course of several hundred years that the printing press has been a thing, there have been many, many, many copies of that book printed. And a lot of it, and right now, you can get a copy basically just by going to the Gideons and saying, hey, can I have one of those, please?
Well, and if you felt compelled by the threat of of eternity in a lake of fire to spread the book Harry Potter. I think that Harry Potter, people would spend a lot of money buying Harry Potter and giving that out. But no one is compelled and scared that they're going to spend eternity in a lake of fire if they don't share Harry Potter with people.
And just imagine what, when you brought up Harry Potter, just imagine what would happen if someone tried to organize a bring Harry Potter books to school day in Kentucky.
Oh, dude.
There would be such a huge backlash.
Hey, this is a challenge to all librarians in Kentucky, all public school teachers. Have a Harry Potter Day, a statewide declared bring Harry Potter to school day. I would love to see that. I would love to see that shoved in Matt Bevin's face.
Anything that angers Focus on the Family will probably make me happy.
And this is literally only an argument for popularity. And the thing is like the Quran is also massively popular, if it's not more popular, because there's the populations of Christians and Muslims are actually pretty close. So, I mean, why isn't that just as justifiable? Because it's pretty much one for one.
Well, and here's the thing. You're already, as a student, allowed to bring your Bible to school. You're already allowed to read your Bible in school.
Right.
Right? Like, you can go in the lunchroom during your lunch and read your Bible. You can even have your prayer circle at lunchtime with your other peers. You can bow your heads and pray before you eat. You can't use your Bible to usurp math class, right? If I'm in there trying to teach, you know, algebra, you can't say, no, Matt Bevin says I'm allowed to read my book and share it with everyone. No, not during math class. And these are the kinds of things that Governor Bevin is emboldening students to think is their right, either by government declaration or by some higher declaration that compels you to share all these, you know, these Bible verses and extra Bibles with people.
So I'm looking at this article. It says the top most read books in the world. And so it has, according to this graphic, it has the Holy Bible massively in the lead, but it doesn't mention the Quran at all. I wonder why. And then also then after that, second is quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong.
Okay. All
and
right.
Then Harry Potter.
Seriously? Okay.
Yeah.
All
and
right.
Then The Lord of the Rings, The Alchemist by...
is that Coelho?
Yes.
Okay.
I have not heard of that. Da Vinci Code.
Ugh.
Yeah. And then, everybody's favorite, The Twilight Saga.
Okay, so what is the reason for the popularity of these? I think marketing?
Yeah.
Money?
Or perhaps the, like, in the case with, it's definitely not the case with most of the ones that are listed, but the Holy Bible, like, again, how many centuries has that been printed? Over a lot of time, you can sell or give away a lot of copies.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it's also like it's not sold often. So, I mean, every hotel room has it in there. And not because the hotels buy it, but because they're given to them for free. And then there's just this...
And what I think was impressive with... And I was just looking at the same graph off of your screen, is how many copies... of Harry Potter was sold just in the past 20 years or so that book has been existing. And it's like,
already catching up to the Bible.
Yeah, considering it's Harry Potter's at 400, whatever, they're 400 million or something like that.
400 million, but it's like, what, 3.9 billion Bibles?
For 20 years. Yeah, I think it could catch up to the Bible.
Well, we'll see whether Harry Potter will catch up to the Bible or whether it'll be Lord of the Rings that pulls ahead. Hopefully not Twilight.
Right.
You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Alvey, and we'll be back after the break. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, where sometimes people ask us, as atheists, certain questions. We've got a question from Bronson from Tacoma, and I'm so glad that, Nick, you're on this episode, because, Nick, you're a musician, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah. Would you like to say what band you're in and what kind of music you do?
My band is called Bess. We are a four-piece prog rock band that is... bouncier than most other prog rock bands, and we have a really good saxophone player too.
Cool. Yeah, I love it. And, you know, it's been really fun to have you as part of the Ask an Atheist family for so many years as a musician that has, I don't know, gotten sort of traipsed in and out of different sort of atheisty things and using your music as a vehicle for that. So this kind of question I'm going to present to you. Bronson asks, if there is no God, how do you explain minor major seven chords? Checkmate, ask an atheist.
Well, Bronson, I don't mean to brag, but...
Ooh, explain that for us, Nick.
It's tangible. I can play it. I can hear it.
So I think that this may have been asked in slight jest, right? Because we get so many of those kinds of like, how do you explain the human eyeball, atheist? Huh? Checkmate. How do you explain the sky being blue? Huh?
Or the trees. Explain the trees.
Yeah. Did you get that one? I got that one at a bus stop once. How do you, as an atheist, explain that there's trees all around us? Well, they grow from seeds or from spores or from pine cones. Or
yeah, they're physical, tangible, and they reproduce on their own.
Yeah. So major, minor, minor, major seven chords. What's the music theory behind these?
Okay. So what I played was a D minor, major seven. So this is a D chord. This is a D major seven. This is a D minor. This is a D minor, major seven. It's names of things that sound contradictory when you say them to people or who are not musicians.
Okay, so it's like, you can't have something major and minor together, huh?
Yes, you can.
Okay, all right, cool.
It's purposefully dissonant.
Oh, I get it. Okay, that almost goes into our next topic, too.
Oh, our next topic? What's that one, Josh?
So Mike from the internet asks, does logic have boundaries?
Oh, I love this one. You know, there's so many people that say like, I'm an atheist and I'm perfectly logical in everything. Logic is my guiding force. And I don't think that it's God. It is logic. And people will say, you just made logic your God. Checkmate, atheist. Right. You heard some of that, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, as an atheist, I really like things to be logical. One of the reasons that I look at religious beliefs and I say, you know what, I am not subscribing to them is because they don't sit right with me. They are illogical. They don't follow, you know, if A, then B, if B, then C. So if A, then C, you know, those kinds of rules. Like I've seen how geometry works, and I want to be able to apply that to other things. I've seen how logical proofs, you know, follow one another, but it's not my God. And personally, I think that there are some limits to logic. I think there are some boundaries. Do you guys think that there are some boundaries or limits to logic?
I have no logical reason why my favorite burger in the city is my favorite burger. It's what I like. There are certain things that you cannot use logic to, like, why do I have such great affection for my cat? It's not something that is particularly logical. There are some things that you like for the sake of liking them, and it's okay. It doesn't need to be logical. If everything was completely logical, things would be kind of, well, Vulcan.
Yeah, right. The character of Spock was actually created to mock the whole concept of making everything logical.
Okay, so I actually kind of really always liked the Vulcan characters. I also liked the cyborg characters and the android characters. So I liked Seven of Nine in Star Trek. I liked Data in Next Generation. I liked the Vulcans in the original series and in Enterprise.
But yeah, and but they were always set up to be falling on their logic, though, because like they were so logical about everything. Eventually, their logic didn't account for everything. They couldn't account for everything. And so Kirk had to come in and be his brash self and save the day because Spock just wasn't capable of actually being he was too rigid.
Okay. So in terms of when you hold logic to this boundless, limitless thing that should guide everything, you end up with default limits.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
It makes you predictable too.
Okay.
So the thing is like also, so everybody thinks like as long as they have a logical framework, it doesn't matter if they tested it or not. They think they're justified to believe whatever they want. Just all you have to do is set up logical framework. then nobody can sell you. But that's not how it works. I mean, you if you don't do the legwork to see if your logic actually works, I mean, you're essentially programming video games that can be played in a simulation but have no real influence on the real world or actually take into account all the variables of the real world.
I like that analogy you have there between video games, and because video games have gotten super creative in the, you know, 37 years that I've been alive, and you know the number of different twists and turns that that a video game can take, and incorporating, you know, multiple players into a place and massive multiplayer online games. Yeah. They're still guided by a series of algorithms and codes, right?
It's still pure logic, but it's no way. And so if you're just a logical person based on, and you don't want to, you just want to come up with a logic of basis, a logical basis for what you believe in without testing it, you're not, you're just basically saying that it's going to work because it worked in a simulation.
Hmm. Okay. I also like the look of, you know, when something fails, when logic fails, it doesn't account for other kinds of things like personal preferences. Yeah. You know, you use the example of the original series of Star Trek where Kirk, his character, comes in all brash to save the day. There's other places where I see logic as something that is too rigid. And it's not that brashness is a thing that saves the day, but gentleness or compassion that can save the day. You know, it might be completely logical to say, hey, your grandma's dead and we've buried her. And so now she is no more, right? That's logical, but that's not comforting. That's not gentle to every individual. You know, other people might need different things. And you can say, well, let me look from a compassionate lens, a compassionate framework, instead of just breaking something down into logic. Now, for me, when my cat was in the process of dying and when he had died, there was something that was that comforted me, that was very clinical, very logical, very easy to understand. And that was the thing that happened to be comforting to me. There are other people that find comfort in something that has no logic to me, which is some rainbow bridge poem where your little furry buddies get to meet you in your afterlife. And I'm like, that's not logical to me, because, and I've gone over this at length in a past episode of Ask an Atheist, where say, that's not logical, because when you grow old, presumably you've had many pets. And what if you've had a pet that is really fearful of other animals? And then are they all there at the rainbow bridge and they're all going to, like, you know, meet each other? Are they, have they given up their fears of other animals? Are they going to get along? What's going on? That's not logical to me. But to someone else, that's incredibly comforting. So a boundary to logic might be, what does this person need in this moment? I don't know. One might say that there is a certain logic to that. There's a certain logic to compassion. There's variables that you can play for and that you can judge for. But I think that, Josh, you've hit upon it when you say you got to test that logic. You know, you could say, I'm going to use compassion, but I don't know if it'll work. Maybe it'll help this person feel better. This is a thing that tends to help people feel better. I'm going to test it, though, and not say that this is something completely devoid of logic, nor completely wonderful, because I'm being compassionate. So why aren't you feeling better when I'm comforting you in this way? I don't know. Nick, do you have any other kinds of experiences where someone has gotten too logical at you to the point where you say, hey, this is a boundary, this is a limit where it's not working?
The one time that I can think of was when I was 19 and I was pulled over for driving 31 and a 25. And the police officer who pulled me over, the first thing that he said was, I am not here to give warnings. I am here to give citations. I am cop bot.
Oh, did you have a Vulcan as your cop?
I don't know. He was wearing a hat.
So you couldn't see his ears?
Yeah.
Okay, so you felt that was kind of...
It was, like, because it's easy to go 6 miles an hour over the speed limit, and the first time that, you know, the first time that you get pulled over and someone says, I'm not here to give warnings, I'm here to give citations, that seems a little rigid. Yes, it is based in logic, and I was breaking the law at the same time in a very, very minor sense, but also at the same time, like, what good was it doing society to pull me over and give me a $124 ticket 2 blocks away from where I was living when I was going to the grocery store to get 2 packets of ramen?
Well, you were endangering people, you know? I mean, I don't know. I think that what this looks at is that you can use logic as something to guide everything in your life, and the result will be that people may not receive you warmly. You know, people may be turned off by that. And looking at where the balance between the rigidity of logic and thinking that everything's going to be a flow chart in your life, you know, the human brain has a very difficult time accounting for so many things. You know, there have been studies that show that we can do chunks of up to 7 items, right? We can remember 7 things. That's why lots of phone numbers are 3 and 4, right? And then anything beyond that, we have an area code, which is its own item where we've taken 3 items and put them into 1, right? Mm-hmm. And Tacoma is a 253. Well, that ends up being 1 thing. The human brain can't possibly have, the average human brain can't possibly have all of these factors held on to and in order to perfectly determine the perfect deterministic outcome. And on top of that, thinking that everything and operating your life as if everything is deterministic is something that is a little bit depressing, because it takes away that sense of agency and autonomy for you to change the world, impact other people, and even have to monitor yourself in terms of your own impacts on others.
Yeah, so laws actually should require some kind of compassion to be implemented then, because look at all the things that have been legal throughout our history. Slavery was legal. It was illegal to harbor slaves. But the compassionate view of that is that you don't own slaves and you try and save anybody. If you could, you try and, you don't return slaves to their slave owners. And that was legal though. That was the legal framework that existed at the time.
So just following a set of rules can be a thing that maybe individuals can aspire to, but even as we as atheists, we recognize that logic is not the be-all, end-all. And so having those kinds of boundaries and limits and then incorporating morality and compassion into your life is, I think, something that is the thing that's going to get you that well-rounded beauty of life.
It's a good start. You should start off with a logical basis and then build upon that based on how it actually reacts to the real world.
Well, if you have a question for us about logic or about compassion or about boundaries or limits or God or anything, give us a call at 844-SKEPTIC and leave us a voicemail that we may address in a future episode. Tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. Find us on Facebook at the same place. Email us questions at atheist.radio. Thank you, Josh, and thank you, Nick.
You're welcome.
See you later.
See you guys next week.